hopeful that Eros, that love, is gentle and is a taming force, which is quite interesting. I don't think everyone in the ancient Greek world would have thought that Eros is a taming force, but that Eros is a taming force comes from these kind of surface qualities, you know?
Well, you know, so at the beginning, at the very, very beginning of Agathon's speech, he says, I want first to talk about how I should talk and then talk. And then he goes on to say, you know, we've been talking about the impacts that Eros has, but let me praise Eros and basically praise all his qualities. But I also think that this first line is very clearly a, you know, put there by Plato as kind of a hint of what's to come. And also it's just a basic, almost like a general definition of, okay, like this is a rhetoric speech, right?
This is what we call in the business a framing device, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're going to see Agathon be focused very much on how he's going to say things and how he's going to speak about Eros. And what he's going to do is just extensively praise Eros in effectively every angle that he can. And, you know, you might, like, we might wonder, like, okay, well, why is he doing that? What's the argument there? Well, one aspect from the rhetorical perspective is that, you know, think about where thinking about the audience that Agathon has for this speech and their concerns with Eros so far. And it, you know, it's probably worth noting that kind of like the controversial or like at least interesting side of symposium is a lot of the love concerned with is concerns with older men, who these presumably are, and younger boys or guys. There's a lot of this is the general reference that's going on in Greek society at this time, particularly in the more like aristocratic or upper echelon circles, which all these characters are part of. These are all more well-to-do, educated, literate individuals, you know, probably with strong family ties within the Athenian society. It was quite customary for older men to take younger male lovers. This is often referred to as being, like, I know sometimes people talk about being pedophilic. You know, I have to look into it a little bit more. But from my understanding, yeah, obviously, like, today we'd be like, this is, like, not okay. But it was more, like, a complex and, like, layered relationship.
Yeah, well, the way that I have been taught and I've been taught it and understood it is that it is a social institution for the moral education of the free male citizens of Athens. It was a way for young men to be socially, morally, politically integrated into Athenian society, was through these close sexual relationships. They, on the surface and kind of in terms of the, what we might call the optics of it, it was to be played as like concerned for, you know, you were educating them, you were taking them under your wing, but there was a very obvious erotic component to it, which you will see sort of poked at even in the symposium. It, you know, older men can be made to be embarrassed by alluding to this erotic component to it, whereas they very much want to play it off as refined and sort of edifying.
Yeah, and that's exactly getting to the point I was wanting to make with this is, you know, basically Agathon is performing for a audience who is heavily entrenched in this culture, in this practice. And Eros, as a reflection of that, is highly positive because there's a direct link between that kind of activity and the kind of love that they're concerned with and Eros's relationship or injection into that, right? And so coming back to the rhetorical flourishment, if Eros is displayed as being a highly, highly positive being, a highly, highly positive force, positive entity, God, that has really only good things to bring to the table, then it follows that this practice or this cultural aspect that is directly related with Eros is also, you know, looked on very positively and has a strong, like, buttress for its reasons for why it's there and why you feel the way you should in these sorts of, in these kinds of relationships. And so that, I think, is a tacit rhetorical background, right? And it, what it is, you know, within the context of, let me look at the note I have here, but within the context of rhetoric, it's playing into the effectively the pathos of the argument, right? The emotive side that people have within this kind of this discussion, this concern, right? Of like, oh, I'm really invested in this practice. I'm emotionally invested, and like, let me feel good about it. Well, how can I feel good about it? Well, Eros is fantastic, and he's very closely involved in this relationship. So it's appealing to the pathos, you know, what Aristotle would call pathos within relationships or different types of arguments, effectively appealing to the passions. And this is a really powerful and important kind of rhetoric. And I think reading Agathon's speech, it's one of the ones that comes up the most, is this kind of implicit appeal to passion.
Yeah. It's interesting. So I noticed that explicitly too, when I think about, maybe this, we have, you know, nowadays, and I'm sure that this phenomenon was sort of noticed earlier, but we have ideas of things like projection or reading into, or what, you know, wanting to see something just because it's kind of a favored object. And I think that bringing up the Piderist tradition is kind of trying to allude to what might be being read into here. There is this worry, say, if you want to praise what the best thing is, well, if someone is, you know, I'm just going to pick like a random example. If someone thinks that horses are just the zenith, the peak, there is this idea that, well, when you go to praise the highest thing and you want to go and look and investigate it, or just praise it even, well, guess what you're going to put there? You're going to put horses, right? So singing the praises of a young and supple man just kind of goes to psychologically reinforce what is already there, right? And I think that the comparison or the, well, you're kind of just putting them next to each other, but I think one of the reasons that you might be doing that that is interesting is the legitimation of this particular tradition of, and not only the legitimation of the pederast practice, but the legitimation of the rhetorical sort of the rhetorical institutions in Athens as well. Not only are you psychologically legitimating love between, you know, older and younger men, but you're using rhetoric to do that. And in that way, the sight of two sort of institutions legitimating one another, sort of relying on each other in this, like using the, I'm trying not to use the word pathetic, because in English pathetic means something different, but in terms of pathos, that's what pathetic, there's a classical meaning of pathetic, their pathetic appeal, their appeal to pathos, and relying on something more fundamental than rhetoric or eros, but pathos.
Absolutely. And I think too, you can see this in other ways as well. Like that, and I think this is an important part of, you know, speaking about rhetoric and how, you know, Agathon was effectively a kind of rhetorician in his own time, being a poet. But even looking at like the different aspects of, you know, what are considered aspects of persuasion, aspects of rhetoric. You have things like, you know, the arrangement and the style as well. You know, I'm not going to get too much into like the structural style, because this is not something that I'm like super well versed in terms of like the really in-depth, you know, types of, you know, meter and stuff used. Yeah. But there is very obviously like a really clear structure going on with Agathon's poem, probably more than most of the other speeches, where he's basically like, okay, I'm going to talk about it. And what I'm going to go through is basically, it's almost effectively, there's a little bit of like a bullet point comparison going on here, or maybe not comparisons, but association, right? Going through, you know, unsurprisingly, virtues were another very important part of you know, Greek society, and I guess, yeah, and discussion around virtues and all that kind of stuff.
They were the parts that composed a good character. So you need to talk about those parts.
Yeah, and this was a generally accepted, like, this was like, yeah, there are a commonly accepted popular perspective, at least within the context of Agathon's audience members, like that kind of echelons of society. And so, you know, he even says as much as he goes through. He says, you know, talking about how that the gods justice, virtue, and courage and wisdom, right? So he's literally taking virtues that he knows are important to people. He knows that's how people at his time and place register character, right? Effectively, their ethical values, moral values, and then inserting eros into each one of those values and saying, okay, well, again, taking something that's not actually eros, but is a structurally social, cultural component of society that people have considerably amount, there's a high amount of investment in, and then turning around and saying, okay, that thing that you obviously all care about, guess what? It's actually eros. So therefore, like, you know, because there's a sort of relation between the two, like eros is good because justice is good, and eros is good because virtue is good, and eros is good because courage is good, and eros is good because wisdom is good. Now, the way he's performing those arguments is saying, okay, here's how eros is in each one of those things. But I think the rhetorical argument structure is the association between them, right? Not making necessarily strong logical arguments about why eros is this way or not, but by making a basically flourish that associates him with those things, the audience then associates eros with, oh, I see eros in being wise, I see eros in being courageous, all these wonderful things that I praise in other people, or I hope the others praise in myself, are associated with eros, therefore he is like obviously the best.
Yeah, I mean, this goes, I mean, this is kind of a theme, I think, that runs up to, like, specifically Agathon's speech, but also, you know, the earlier speeches as well. They kind of build on the same era. And this is the idea of presupposing what is good about eros and then just praising that. There's no real room for a sort of negative space for love, right? There's nothing that love isn't. I mean, we saw that with Eryximachus' speech, right? Where he takes the divine love and expands it to the motions of the universe. There's nothing that isn't moved by love in the universe. Obviously, the question then becomes, okay, well, if you're praising love as just everything, then you're not really giving it you're not giving it a lot of specificity. You're not saying what love is. I think that's one of the ways that Agathon is trying to refine and fill in. He can appear to be giving eros particularity by saying, well, eros has this character, eros has this beauty, eros has this has these consequences. But interestingly, just because they've been assigned their particularity, that doesn't mean that they aren't just as universally applicable, or we might say abstract or meaningless, right? especially if you keep making the same move that Agathon and previous speakers make, maybe with the exception of Aristophanes, which is interesting as well, but that you presuppose Eros is the good, and then there's nothing good you can't assign to Eros. And it's interesting too, because once you have done that, there is something interesting to the rhetorical method that I am seeing in Agathon's speech, which I think is this play of dualities, right? So it starts right at the beginning where he says, I'm going to talk about the qualities of what Eros is, but those qualities always have opposites, right? So if you talk about he starts by talking about the appearance. Well, he begins by talking about the relation of Eros to the rest of the gods, that he's the youngest and he's kind of new on the pantheonic scene, and he introduced love, and he doused all flames of violence among the gods, which I'm sure that the comedians and the tragedians would not be very happy to hear, because the quarrels with the gods are what make the gods interesting. You know, we all hear about the agonal spirit of the ancient Greeks, and they are deified. They beef with each other. That's what's awesome about them, right?
And it's interesting too, because as you said, like this, you know, he kind of douses all negativity is sort of washed away, and he introduces it as Eros as this character. And he also introduces him as the youngest, but he introduces him as the youngest because he's associated, again, he associates him with like a good quality, which other speakers in this symposium do as well, which is, you know, the area Eros has some correct or direct relationship with youthfulness, right? Even though within the like historical pantheon, he might not actually be like the youngest god in terms of that like family tree, because he's the one that's associated with youth, he is kind of the eternally young. And so then there's some weird mental gymnastics going on in terms of how he shows up later, in terms of Agathon's kind of assessment and stuff like that. But it's, you can see that as well, that it's sort of this constant, positive introduction.
Yeah. So I should, on an interesting note too, you talk about young gods. Eros is different than Aphrodite, but Eros is still quite a primordial god in the pantheon. But what is interesting is in the civic life, Dionysus, he is an introduced god to Athens, and he is quite new to the Hellenic world at the time. So I wonder if there's something that Plato is saying by alluding to the youth of a god and having a tragedian who would have been a writer for the Dionysia. I just wonder if there's something there. But in any case,
you reminded me of what I was actually going to say. It skipped my mind roughly, which is, you mentioned how like what makes the Greek pantheon interesting is the high level of drama that's going on, right? That divisiveness. And that's also reflective of real human life too. And this is, again, where rhetorical speeches, I think you can kind of read a little bit of dismissiveness into Plato's and others' assessments of them, because they often have a tendency to paint, and still in politics today, like, whenever we think about rhetoric, I keep thinking about modern politics because it's so common, this high, high level of idealization, right? And as you kind of mentioned earlier, you know, what Agathon as a rhetorician is doing in terms of taking Eros is basically purifying him, right? It's giving the best account. It's like when an American politician talks about America and talks about, you know, just a flow of like the best stuff, right? It's the best. It's the best in all ways. The issue with that, with Eros, is like, okay, well, real human love, real human relationships, which are displayed more accurately, one would argue, in things, in the writings of like Homer and Hesiod and stuff like that, where there is drama, there is conflict, there is tragedy. And in fact, it's gods like Dionysus who kind of bring that aspect into things that give a fuller picture, a more realistic, a more honest picture in a way of actual human life interactions and existence, right? What Eros has become through Agathon is a highly kind of purified picture that it doesn't really reflect real relationships in a way.
Yeah.
I would say.
No, yeah. I mean, there's an interesting move that Agathon makes where he says, look, Eros has quenched the flames of war, but later on, when he begins, or in the middle of his physical description, he says, everyone knows that love has extraordinary good looks, and between ugliness and love, there is unceasing war. The question is, well, wait, what happened to love taming all? Well, everything that is bad about that, anything that is bad that we could attribute to love as being bad, is something that love is at war with. So really, there's a kind of, I don't want to use the word like repression here, but there is this sort of projection of, well, all of the bad things that we could attribute to Eros are projected outwards. They are things that really Eros is fighting. If there's anything bad going on, which apparently Eros is fighting a war with, it can be sort of sublimated into it. It's this pure pacifist who has to fight ugliness because of just the dialect or the dualistic nature of qualities like good and bad. You're reaching kind of an explosive point of contradiction at this point, which, I mean, it sort of plays into the rhetorical strategy that Agathon has to work with as well, right? I was talking earlier about the dualistic nature of the way that sort of his descriptions work, and it provides a scaffolding for a speech, right? So you start with one thing, talk about their physical appearance, and then you move into their moral character, the invisibles, right? You don't really have to, if you're a trained speech maker, you just know to grab the one branch, and then when you swing, grab the other branch, and then you're through the forest, you know? You don't have to really pay attention to any of the qualities. You have a template, and that template is the dualistic nature of language, the fact that when you talk about good, you have to talk about bad. When you talk about appearances, you have to talk about non-appearances. When you talk about someone's physical appearance, that also suggests the things that aren't physical about them. When you talk about the things that aren't physical about them, you talk about the way that those non-physical things manifest and whatnot. You always have something in language to lead you along. You don't actually have to look at the thing in itself. As long as you know, you just say it's good.
Which is a really, you know, interesting divide from how, you know, the rest of the symposium goes once Plato introduces Socrates and his sort of retort or discussion of Eros, which effectively, we don't need to get too much into it here, but takes on a far more of a dialectic, of a truth-seeking mission, but ultimately in a way sort of goes beyond Eros, right? It sort of goes beyond a question of like praising this god. Was he about the saying, you know, spoilers, it's an opportunity for Socrates to move into discussions effectively about the forms, right? Or forms of the beauty, forms of the good, which Eros is effectively a stepping stone to discuss. But that's a very different kind of speech structure than what Agathon is trying to do. Like, Agathon is performing, what makes the speech relatively short, interesting, is it's a very, like, classically laid out sort of praise speech, right? As you were just saying, and it uses those comparison of opposites and basically shoveling everything within those opposites. All you got the good and the bad, taking every good side and shoveling it into, you know, the subject that you want to argue for while negating the other side as a way of basically convincing or riling up a audience or pulling them to your side, because obviously, you know, like, all this good stuff is over here and here's why the bad stuff is not, you know, like, this is not a part of that, or we can exclude that because for this reason or whatever, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A young person could never be old, so I don't need to talk about the oldness. And that just comes from the fact that young and old are sort of diametrically opposed in language. And it does come to a head, doesn't it? It, at the end of Agathon's speech, we get this sort of moment of inspiration. We get this moment of inspiration where it's almost like, you know, as per the understanding of the way that the poets are enthused by the muses, love almost breathes these qualities into the poet to be able to speak in the meter that a poet should properly be able to speak in. Now, I don't know if the translation you're reading, or I'm reading a different translation, I'm reading Nehalmas and Woodruff, but I don't think that they attempt to capture the meter specifically, but we do obviously see a very different shift in the way that the language is being used. It's no longer going through a particular trait and then saying how one thing follows from another. It's almost this mere enumeration and the observers. So there is, you know, he refers to the wise men and how the wise men see and the gods admire. There just is this basking in an onslaught of beautiful qualities that comes to this very deflated ending. This, Phaedrus, is the speech I have to offer. Let it be dedicated to the god. Part of it in fun, part of it moderately serious, as best as I could manage. He's done after he's said his bit, which it's just such a, I mean, we listen to the speech. It is so, it's so rhetorically flourished. You wonder psychologically what is going on with Agathon in this moment. Maybe we'll have to talk about that, but you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. We've been discussing Agathon's speech in Plato's Symposium. I'm Brandon. I've been joined by Hale. Thank you for listening.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You are tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
This is Bird Note.
Join us now for another Brooklyn ball game. This is the old redhead, Red Barber.
Longtime Brooklyn Dodger and later New York Yankee announcer Red Barber grew up in Mississippi and was known for his folksy way of speaking.
They call him the Big Cat, and he swings that heavy bat as though it weighed no more than a dry turkey feather.
One of his best-known catchphrases was that a player in a winning position was sitting in the catbird seat.
Delivers outside for ball three, and it's 3-0. Fry's sitting up there in the catbird seat.
But what is a catbird seat? And what, for that matter, is a catbird? Well, the catbird part is easy. It's a cousin of the mockingbird in the bird family known as the mimids. And it does sound a little like a cat. As for the saying, it's been around since the 19th century, probably originating in the southern U.S., where there are lots of gray catbirds. The bird is normally a skulker, foraging near the ground or in dense underbrush. But during the breeding season, gray catbirds sometimes fight amongst themselves for the best territories. As part of the competition, the two combatants sing their way to higher and higher perches. The one who finally takes the highest perch is, well, sitting in the catbird seat, with the best view, in control, top bird, so to speak. So take it from Red Barber. The Catbird Seat is the place to be. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.